Welcome to Frameline. I'm Barbara Gostowski, here as usual with my favorite critic, Courtney Small.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Great, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks.
Great. Okay, so we have got a lot of stuff that's opening up in theaters, and we've got something exciting on streaming. It's already started, but we'll talk about it anyway, because it's just that kind of thing. It's interesting. Courtney's going to start us off with a big release.
Sure. So one of the films you can catch out in theaters right now is Monkey Man. It's the directorial debut of actor Dev Patel. And Dev Patel, he directed, wrote the original story for, produced, and stars in this action thriller. And it's, you know, from the trailers, you might get the sense that it's kind of like a John Wick type of action film. I know it's been affectionately dubbed John Wick in Mumbai, but it's definitely to put a little more deeper thought into his film and what's going on. Essentially, he plays this character known as Kid, and Kid has been suffering from childhood trauma, and he's basically spent his entire life wanting to get vengeance on the corrupt police chief and people that, I guess, control the police chief, if you will, that caused his community to be forcefully evacuated from their land and also resulting in the death of his mother. So now Kid spends a lot of his time in this underground boxing ring where he wears a monkey mask, and it's a reference to a childhood story that he was told by his mother about Hanuman. And Hanuman is this half monkey, half human deity that got punished by the gods because he accidentally ate the sun. His hunger, he thought it was a mango. And that whole story kind of foreshadows Dev Patel's character, as Kid has essentially been, you know, living in poverty and in the slums and fighting in these illegal fights so that he can gain enough money and set plans in motion so that he can infiltrate the upper crust. And he does that by working as a dishwasher in this hotel, and then starts to make connections so that he can literally move up the ladder, if you will, and be a butler in the penthouse where this police chief tends to hang out. So that's essentially the premise of it. There's a lot of butts being kicked. But what Dev Patel tries to do with this film, and when I say he tries to do something deeper, is he brings a lot of culture into this film. There's a lot of talk about religion, and there's the good side of religion that is meant to uplift the downtrodden, and then there's those like this particular guru who's using religion for political power and using it to align himself with a lot of the corrupt individuals and kind of control the police force and what have you. So as you're watching Dev Patel try and get his revenge by kicking butts in bathrooms, the back of police cars, there's a lot of great action in this film. He tries to also make you care a little bit more about the characters than you say an average John Wick film where everyone's just an assassin. I thought the film was okay. I didn't love it as much as other critics do. And I think as a director, he shows a lot of promise. Like, he has a great visual eye. The fight scenes are fantastic. You know, there's a good mix of humor. There's some great musical cues in it. But the issue I had with this film is, as a director with a lot of great ideas and a lot of style, he needs to learn how to let the camera just sit and observe. Because he uses a technique where there's a lot of fast edits and a lot of kind of shaky camera. Like, the camera's always moving, even in times when the camera shouldn't be moving. So I use the example of, there's a scene where he has to go through this Diwali street festival, and there are all these people in costumes of like the various deities. And it's like a blink and you miss it moment because everything, the camera's constantly shaking so much. During some of the fight scenes, there's a lot of interesting choreography going on, but you only see half of it because, again, the camera's constantly moving. The edits are too fast. Everything's just at a frantic pace. And the only time it really slows down is when he's having the same flashback about the trauma of his youth, which the film kind of plays out to to death, in my opinion. And I think as a result, because there's so much focus on the constant camera moving and this particular moment of his trauma, a lot of the supporting characters feel very thin in how they're designed, especially in the second half of the film, where he is in this religious temple and he's being surrounded by the transgender community who have also essentially been ostracized. And there's a lot of really interesting messaging about the forgotten. And there's a lot of richness in those characters that never gets really developed, because again, the focus is on this police chief who's essentially just a corrupt police chief. Like, there's no real definition to anything for any of these characters outside of Kid himself. So if you're going for a film that is just like a straight action film that has a little bit more substance, Monkey Man will fit that bill. I just think that for what Patel is trying to achieve with this film, I wish he had slowed things down a bit more and really let the characters and the messaging kind of develop and sink in a bit more.
Yeah, it sounds like he was going more for the adrenaline. Like, he had a lot of ideas, but just in the execution just went more for the adrenaline rush of the experience, right? Yeah. Instead of developing things.
And there is, and you will get a, like, there's this, the climactic fight scene is the build up to it is fantastic. And it's like the last 30 minutes of butts being kicked is just delightful in terms of how it's orchestrated. And, you know, there are nods to other action films. Like, obviously early on, they make a verbal call out to John Wick because they know a lot of people are going to, you know, inevitable, but there's a reference to Enter the Dragon, like a very subtle reference to that. There's some stuff that remind you of the Jason Bourne films. Like, he's kind of studied these movies and brings his own flavor to it. I just wish it wasn't so frenetic every moment. I think if he had just let the camera rest a little more, it would have been a far more powerful film. But again, that's my opinion. Most of the people on my screening loved it. So if you're looking for an action film, you know, Monkey Man is definitely something that you should check out.
Wow. Sounds good. Sounds like an experience. If someone wants a different kind of experience, something a bit more calm and contemplative, but what's interesting is when you were talking about it, it calls out to all these other films, right? La Chimera is a film that it's an Italian film set in Italy, and it calls on all this whole generation of Italian filmmakers, basically like mid-20th century filmmakers. I'm going to attempt to pronounce the filmmaker's name with an Italian accent, so bear with me. Alice Rorroaca, that's my attempt at Italian, and apologies if I messed that up. Anyway, so she creates this gorgeously complex vision of a world that's filled with ghosts and treasures. And it's kind of it's a thriller of sorts that's also romantic. And it's really the world of tomb raiders. And what happens is the world of the Tomb Raiders starts to take on metaphorical. And I hope nobody gets scared off by that word, because it's like, it's metaphorical on a couple of levels, but it's like just a great suspenseful kind of thing to follow, as well as having this like great atmosphere and this gorgeous Tuscan landscape, you know, gorgeous sun-drenched landscape. And so it's this Arthur is this treasure hunter. He is played by Josh O'Connor, and he's sort of like the expat in this landscape who has this power. La Chimera is his power. It's this that's part of the phantasmic world that this film summons. Like, he has this ability to sense when there is an ancient tomb around that he and his buddies can dig up and raid. And so it's a world of intrigue as well, because it's like, you know, art the whole art dealing, art selling, and going after these treasures and being the first and things like that. What makes the film incredible is the way that the filmmaker shoots it. It's shot in a straightforward way on one level, but then there are times when she incorporates 16 millimeter and Super 16, and so that the textures of the film, which are very vivid to begin with, but the textures of the film take on different, it's like a patchwork quilt in some ways, because that's when, you know, she uses some of these different film stocks for like memory and some for visions and some for, you know, and it gives you this, like, it's just saturated colors, but it's also saturated with like meaning and feeling and atmosphere and characters. The characters in this, they're all like something out of Fellini in the best way. Like, it is circus-like in a way. So you've got this serious thriller Tomb Raider thing, but you've got this Fellini-esque band of guys, mostly guys, going after these treasures. And then in the middle of it, you've got Isabella Rossellini playing Flora, who's basically sitting in this tomb of her own, this crumbling villa. It's crumbling around her, but she just insists on living there. And even her walls are filled with treasures. And she's got this, it's like there's some sort of sirens of mythology or something, like her daughters. I think there's like seven of them that keep coming in. And they're like tomb raiders who come in and are like telling her what to do and bugging her and like always like, oh, picking up a lamp and, oh, can I have this? You're not using it. Like that kind of thing. So in terms of, she's kind of like this Pasolini kind of figure, like an Anna Magnani, the great actress Anna Magnani, like she's kind of referencing that. So the film is constantly referencing things and bringing things up on its own. It's highly original in this way, even though it's referencing all these other Italian filmmakers. And it's like, it's set in the 80s, but it could be like any time earlier than that. In Italy, I love and the way that it brings all the worlds together at the end, like the nether world, the ghost like world with the present world, and everything gets wrapped up. I can't wait to watch this one again, and it's glorious on the big screen. So,
oh, that sounds wonderful. I'll have to check that one out. I've heard a lot of great things, but I missed it when it was on the festival circuit, so I'm definitely hoping to catch it now.
Yeah, so it was on the festival circuit last year, and then it's being released this year. So in terms of one of the best of this year, I think we've already got one of our first candidates in La Chimera.
Mm. Sounds great. I'm going to talk about another film that I saw that maybe on my year-end best, maybe not. I don't know. It's been a film that I've been wrestling with since I saw it. And I think that's, you know, probably the best compliment I can give a film, is that it hasn't left my mind. And it is the new film by director Alex Garland, and it is Civil War. And Alex Garland is a director who some people might remember from, I believe he did Ex Machina and Annihilation a few years ago. But this one really touches on state that America is heading towards. And it's set kind of in a near future where the second Civil War has broken out in America. And part of the reason it's broken out is that they have a president of the United States who refuses to speak to media. I think he hasn't addressed media directly in 14 years. He has openly used the military on civilians. He's dismantled the FBI, and America's essentially descended into chaos. So you have the American army that the president obviously controls, but then you also have these other groups that I think it's like the Western forces, which I think, if I remember correctly, are comprised of like Texas, Florida, California, that are all teaming together against to fight this dictatorship that is kind of taken over. But what makes this film so interesting is it's told from the perspective of a group of traveling journalists. So you have Kirsten Dunst, who plays Lee, and she's like this famed wartime photographer who's kind of seen it all and thought that by filming the stuff and being impartial at war scenes and documenting all these atrocities around the world, that it would be sending a message to America that, hey, you don't want to follow that. But now she's seeing this civil war breakout, so she's a little disenfranchised. And she's traveling with Joel, who's played by Wagner Moura, and he's a reporter. And their goal is to somehow make it from New York to Washington, D.C., so that they can interview the president. Because again, he hasn't spoken to anyone in the media in over a year, and they want to be the ones to get there. But of course, traveling across America as a civil war has broken out is a very tricky thing. So along the way, they have a journalist with them who's a more wiser fellow, but he's old, can't move around as much, Sammy. And then there's this young photographer who wants to be like Lee, and her name is Jessie, and she's played by Kaylee Spaney, who you will remember from Priscilla, because she played Priscilla in that one. So she's kind of young, idealistic, and essentially the four of them are in this vehicle traveling across America. But what makes this film so tense is you don't know who to trust, because when all the norms that we know of, all the decorum, all the laws are no longer existent, it is essentially a dystopian landscape, a no man's land. So you don't know if you're stopping for gas, if the people are friend or foe. They go to a certain park and someone's shooting at you. You don't know if they're shooting at you because they think that you're on whatever side, or if it's just some personal group that has decided to form their own mini militia, or maybe someone just protecting their home. So as they're making this very tense and dangerous trek across America, we get a glimpse of society, but also the role of the media and how, you know, often journalists are the heroes that kind of present the world to us, but also what happens to the journal themselves when they get jaded or vice versa. They become so enamored by the adrenaline rush of being at the forefront. How does that also change their perspective of what's going on in the world? It's a really fascinating film. There's a lot of tension. There's the last 30 minutes, there's this crazy action sequence that happens outside the White House that is kind of edge of your seat. I don't know if I like the ending, but because something happens to some of the characters along the way, and as you're watching their change, I think it also changes how you view some of the messaging that Garland is bringing in this film, especially when it comes to media, and as I was saying about the adrenaline rush, right? And then we'll what becomes more important, you know, getting the story or pausing certain aspects of the story? It's a really, I have to be vague because I don't want to spoil it, but I do think it's an interesting film. It's one that might divide audiences, but if anything, I think will get people talking, because again, you're seeing society crumble in America and the horrors that come about it. And then, because of how it's set up and framed, there's a lot of it that you're like, well, we're not that far from reaching that point. Like, we like to think, well, oh, that's just film. That would never happen, or at least not way. But it's like, well, we're actually not that far. Like, as we're speaking, there's an election going on in America where a man with several criminal charges is running to be reelected, you know, to the office that he once held. And so it's, you know, it's not that far-fetched, but it's just a really interesting film that is filled with a lot of action and a whole lot of tension.
Is that possibly what makes you unsure of how about your reaction? Not unsure, but like makes you wonder about your reaction to the film? Is it that sometimes when a film just refuses to like it brings everything to the fore, all the sides, and then it won't pick a side, right? It's like it leaves you like with this unbalanced
It's not necessarily that it won't pick a side. It's, I think a lot of my issue has to go with the Jesse character and things that happen to Jesse throughout, things that Jesse causes that reverberates, and then how Jesse's character is handled in the, towards the end of the film. And there, I don't know. I think maybe there are certain things that are going to be kind of obvious once you see it, but there's how do I, there's a sense of recklessness that happens throughout this film, not just Jesse, but some of the other characters as well, where some people are afforded that recklessness and others are not. So think about America being divided, an America where there are no rules, and as you see through the film, there's a great scene with Jesse Plemons, who you see in the trailer of the film, so this is not a spoiler, where they come across his character and he's very much a dude who's got the army fatigue, he's doing some stuff, but they don't know if he's just on his own, if he's part of the militia, what have you. And they say, "We're Americans." And he says, "Well, what type of American are you?" And that causes a really tense scene as they have to explain what part of America they originate from. And certain people, depending on the answer that you give, will depend on what happens to you in that moment, right? So think about it now if you're a person of color. That question has a whole different connotation just based off American history, immigration, culture, what have you. And to see how things like that play out, how Jesse witnesses the atrocities, stuff like that, and is completely like kind of shaken by a moment like that. But then you see her later on, and the adrenaline rush is kicking in, and there's a certain recklessness that's occurring. It's a little annoying, right? That was what was driving me. Like, because it's like it felt like you were saying that journalists have to suppress so much by being objective, and whether or not that's good or bad, because you're telling the story, but then you're also witnessing people get killed, experience all this trauma, and you absolutely do nothing. And then also because they're so engaged to get the story, they'll do whatever it takes to get the story, which also puts people in jeopardy. And it's like, well, it's one thing to kind of silently observe the horror, but then sometimes your enthusiasm causes the horror,
Yes.
right? And I think that's the part of it where I struggle with. And especially when you see it, the Jesse character is one that I think people are going to be talking about the most, because the things that happen, I was sitting back going, yeah, it wouldn't have happened if Jesse was not X or did not do X kind of thing.
But
So.
is this just a reflection of what actually happens in journalism? I mean, this is a question that's even been debated in documentary filmmaking, right? How many films it's like, well, you just the camera person or the filmmaker behind the camera, whoever is observing, and they see something and something happens and they could have prevented it, or the presence of the camera causes things to happen in a certain way, right?
It could
So
be.
it's making making you like wonder, because or driving you crazy, because it's like this is just bringing that to the foreground in this film, right?
Yeah, it could be.
Still,
It
so I'm
could
not
be.
questioning you, right? I'm just
It's one that I definitely want to revisit.
I
If you
have
do
to
see it
see
on
this now.
IMAX, it is you're the big screen of IMAX, pulls you in, but I think it doesn't matter what format you see. I think it's a film that will pull you in, and it's going to trigger some type of emotion, whether you like it or you hate it. It's you can't walk away from Civil War and be indifferent. I think that's the type of, which is again a testament to Garland's filmmaking. But it's definitely a visceral experience that you'll be thinking about.
Wow, now that sounds good. Yeah. One way or the other. All right. Well, so I'm gonna go back into the Italian landscape.
Sure.
I did not plan it this way this week, But apparently, I've been in sunny Italy. First, I was in Tuscany, and now you're going to join me in the southern part, in the Naples area. We're going to talk about Ripley, streaming now on Netflix, and starring, of course, as everyone has been saying, starring Andrew Scott. And also starring Dakota Fanning and Johnny Flynn, but Andrew Scott brings his interpretation of the famous Ripley character. It was a book, it was a movie. So now we've got this TV limited series, 8 episodes. And basically, Tom Ripley has been hired by a wealthy man to go to Italy to track down his wayward son. Like, the son's not really responding, doesn't want to come home. And the father, it's mostly the mother actually of this guy. Tom Ripley is supposed to like see if he can get Dickie to come back home because the mother is really suffering. But Tom is down and out. He's the wealthy man finds him in New York City. Tom is really struggling, down and out, kind of a grifter, not kind of a grifter, definitely a grifter. So we see him in one light, and then we see him in, when he gets to Italy. Like, we see these different sides of him, which I'll get into in a second. But the most amazing thing about this series is that it is shot in the most gorgeous black and white. It's got this film noir kind of look, especially in the beginning with the New York scenes. Very, very film noirish. The patterns like constantly around him, the way it frames him, the way things like that. But then throughout the film, Tom is always framed in doorways. I mean, that's an old film noir trick, but it's also an old artsy cinema trick, because this is also the series is referencing a lot of old Hollywood movies, especially Hitchcock, and being in the Italian landscape, of course, it's referencing like Italian cinema as well. So it's shifts and references like different things throughout this thing. So what happens is, like, if you don't know the Ripley story, is that Tom, not really, if you don't know him, like, you're not really sure of his motivations at first. He seems, because he's a grifter, it's like, what are his motives? And then he gets there, and Dickie and his girlfriend Marge are there, and he gets in with them, and Dickie starts to accept him, and then this sort of weird triangle forms. But you realize that Ripley, who has nothing, really wants Dickie's life. And then it's a matter of the characters that are there around Dickie and the ways that Ripley is trying to like get into a life that he doesn't belong in. And I think like Andrew Scott brings a different kind of interpretation. His Ripley is really awkward at times. At first, he's very grifter-like. So there's like this cold, hard edge to him. Then he gets to Italy and he seems totally out of his element. It's almost humorous the way he's struggling. Like, there's this like series of jokes with this the amount of stairs that are in this landscape that he has to climb to get to Dickie. He's constantly going up and down and he's struggling. This perfectly well cut man, Andrew Scott, is like pretending that he's actually out of shape and he's doing it well. And then in his interchanges with Dickie, he's like, he is very awkward. He seems shy sometimes. He seems awkward. And then this is the only trouble I'm having with the series, is that sometimes he just shifts really quickly, and it's like his motivation is like questionable. It's like, why did you just do that? Which, of course, Dickie says. That's the thing. It's like Dickie's like, why did you just do that? And we're it's because it's from Tom's point of view, we're wondering the same thing too. Like, it's like, well, we thought we had an in with Tom, but as it turns out with grifters, you never have an in. So that's the only way that it sort of worked for me, was that Yeah, okay. So I got sucked in by this grifter too. And he got me. I don't know why he's doing this until, the next thing happens and then
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, it's easy to get sucked in by Rip, but I quite enjoyed this series, and I think part of it is because, to your point, Ripley is not a suave individual. Even when he's amongst the high life where that Dickie and Marge are experiencing it, and like the stair scene is a perfect example. You know, he's not fit enough to even handle those stairs. And there's a gag later on in the series that makes reference to those stairs again and again. It shows you those of the upper echelon who can handle all the stairs in Naples and those who can't. And I think one of the interesting things about this series is that because he's not a suave individual, because he's an individual who's always thinking of the next grift but doesn't necessarily have everything planned out properly, it makes it far more interesting to watch him try and execute or watch him try and pivot when he gets backed into a corner. Just because you clearly see that he doesn't really think that far ahead. He's always like, what is the grift in front of me? And then, oh no, there's a situation. How do I pivot? How do I pivot? Sometimes it's luck, sometimes it's, oh, he was really smart about, but nothing comes easy for him. And as much as he's trying to live the easy lifestyle, I think that's quite interesting. And I also love how you're talking about a lot of old time cinematic references and how it leans on film noir. There's also an interesting use of portraits in this film because, you know, because he's one of the high life, there's always some type of painting that he's either looking at or in a book about. But when something happens, the film or the show always goes to a particular painting. And then it kind of like through the painting, you're seeing the emotion of the moment. You know, and whether or not he might have to do something dastardly in this particular moment to get out of it. So the paintings also kind of foreshadow what he might do or what he might not do. So it's quite well done. And I was really impressed by this series. It was one of those and I wasn't sure what to think about it at first. I thought the first episode was really stylish, but I was like, oh, I don't know if they can kind of carry this through 8 episodes. But by the time we get to the second episode, I was hooked. And I think it's just a really well thought out piece. And Andrew Scott is great. And the director, Steve Zaliljan, my apologies if I mispronounced that name, but I think he just did a really good job with this script. And people know him. He's directed a bunch of stuff like Searching for Bobby Fischer, but he also wrote the script for like The Irishman most recently, Schindler's List. Like writing is what I know him for. So I sort of expected that the dialogue in this was going to be quite good, and it is.
Yeah, and it's great to see that he knows how to like tell the story visually as well. And just that point you said about the portraits, it goes along with what I was saying about the framing. Like, well, Andrew Scott's always framed in a door, framed in the landscape somehow. And then he's always looking at these portraits. And sometimes that's actually even a clue to his like a different part of himself, because that there's a I don't This isn't a spoiler, but the first time he sees a Caravaggio, his response to that is very complicated. And it's like you don't expect it from this grifter, right? And that, but then that all coincides with the only times we see him look at himself in the mirror, he's grifting, like he's practicing, right? So it's like getting sucked in by him, like I did, like we do. Is part of the whole game of the series as well, because it's like, or is it part of like his like that? This is the true, I think, strength of the series and Andrew Scott, is that it's just so seamlessly, even though there's like these weird, awkward, and you'd think, if you think about it, you think it's kind of choppy in that way, because it's like he's like this, he's like this, he's like this, but it flows together somehow. And it's, I think it's because of the highly stylized atmosphere that even when there were times where I question his motivation, something would happen. As you say, just like him, his next grift would come along. He would just like make it happen, right?
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of like, what I liked about the scenes where he's practicing is, at first you think, oh, it's a little odd, or sometimes he's practicing things that may never happen. And there are times where he's practicing things specifically because he's plotting it out a certain way and he's hoping that it will go down a particular route that he wants it to go. But there's also, within that practice, there's a lot of subtle call-outs that happen as the series moves on. Like, you know, there's a running thing with an ashtray that makes a whole lot of sense when you see it, but just the amount of times that they call back to that ashtray, which reminds you of this particular thing, like it's quite well done. Like they don't just do it for, oh, that would be kind of cool. Like, I think everything has an interesting type of payoff. Like, it doesn't feel like any moment's kind of wasted. So, yeah, very, very enjoyable series.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so if you're staying at home, watch Netflix. Otherwise, we just give you a whole bunch of films to go to the theater to enjoy different. I think there's a nice variety there. Mm-hmm. And lots to think about. So, that's it for us today. That's it for Frameline. For Courtney Small, I'm Barbara Gosofsky. Thanks for listening.